Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is the chief economic correspondent for the Washington Post and the author of an acclaimed new book, The World's Worst Bet, The Failures of Globalization. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And also check out the links to our sponsors, Naked Wines and ZBiotics, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because when you do, it really helps make this podcast happen. Hey, James, there are so many big, mostly troubling stories this week. A possible government shutdown looming. Huge decisions awaiting a Supreme Court that has rolled over for Trump so far. And the White House is unable to lie its way out of the Jeffrey Epstein scandal. Let's start with the government funding possible shutdown, although it may be the deadline may be delayed with a short-term fix. Unlike in March, when we both thought Schumer was right, that was not the time for Democrats to force a shutdown. They need to make it tough this time. They have to come in with conditions or they won't provide any votes. And there ought to be some non-negotiable demands that Republicans need them to pass the funding bill and they can't roll over. They first demand has to be to extend the Obamacare subsidies that otherwise expire in December. No compromise. Extend them as is. Straight up, otherwise 3.3 million people lose health care coverage and premiums go up for all the others. This is not the time. You can't rewrite the awful Medicaid bill that the Republicans passed this July, but you can address some provisions. Rural hospitals already are closing or cutting services. The Republicans added $50 billion over 10 years to try to stave off some of that. That's not nearly enough. KFF, the great research firm, says it'll cost rural hospitals $137 billion. At least give another $50 billion. Also, there are over 1 million veterans on food stamps. They could get hurt. Make sure they are held harmless by this. And what you don't want to do is go into extraneous measures. This is not the venue to go after Trump's authoritarian outrages. But make it mainly about the cost of living. And I think if you, I think the Democrats have a winning hand this time, James.
I agree, they do. Also, you got to be careful what you ask for because right now the economic numbers are not good. And the forecast, if you listen to anybody, I don't know. I mean, economic forecasting is a very dicey thing, but the forecasts are not very good. And if I'm a Republican, everybody's going to blame them. That Trump got everything he wanted. If you go too far, if I'm them, I want to be able to blame the Democrats for some of the bad economy. Right now, I can't. So you have to be Don Vito Corleone here. You have to make them an offer they can't refuse. All right, that's going to be the trick here. But you don't want to make something that they have any justification not to do it. And I think the things that you suggested are top tier ideas. I kind of like the idea of 125,000 additional cops.
Me too.
Okay, but we can flow in and out. I mean, we can come up with more ideas. The one thing that's not going to happen is they're just going to pass a clean bill or whatever it is. They're not going to do that. There's no appetite for it, and the Democrats would be in open revolt. And they know that. I don't think they need to be told that. But I agree. But, you know, I would put one kind of, quote, non-traditional Democratic thing in the mix. I think it's anything to do with cost of living, and I think you're spot on about the subsidies for health insurance. But we can flush all of this out. I'm working on a piece, and I'm reminded of the Ecclesiastes, the Old Testament book. For everything, there's a time. There's a rhythm.
Exactly.
March was a time to do one thing.
Right.
September, October is a time to do another thing.
Right.
And politics, like the best jazz in the world, it has a rhythm, and you have to flow into the rhythm. And I do 100% agree with you. I don't think there's any appetite to roll over, but I don't think we should be so excessive in our demands that we allowed him any escape for the justifiable blame that they're being held for this increasingly unimpressive economy.
I concur, and standing up for health care benefits, standing up for rural hospitals, standing up for veterans, and I agree with you, more cops. I think that's a very good menu, and I think it fits your criteria, and it puts them in a squeeze.
Yes, and we're going to continue talking about this because we have things to flush out, but I do think we're limited by the kind of rule of threes here. You don't want a laundry list because it's got to be something that you can really explain. And I just hope, my fondest hope is, I think we can do this. I think it's a good issue for her. I hope that the leadership in the House and the Senate designate certain people to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And only yes. certain people. Not everyone is the same level of communicator. And I'm going to bring something up because I know you want to talk about this as I do. This thing that happened last night in Virginia has got their fucking attention. I can assure you.
Another big Democratic win.
Yeah, but not a win. 75-25. Now, according to Cook PVI, it's a plus 18D that we won by 50. I think it's a little bit more. It was kind of 62. Traditionally comes in like 62-38. Governor's race, presidential race, traditionally. This came in at 75-25. The Republicans are not voting. And anything that we can do to demoralize him is really good politics. And we're seeing that in special after special after special. I'm not sure that it's just Democrats. It's easy to just say, oh, the Democrats are just agitated. They're coming out. I think the Republicans, as big a part of this story is they're down. And we can make them get further down.
Yeah, and if they play their hand well in this funding bill, little Mikey Johnson is going to have to pass a bill with as many Democratic votes as Republican votes, and that'll drive his caucus crazy. That'll drive him crazy. He has to beg Master Don to come to his support, but it's going to create real ruptures within that Republican Party if it's done right.
Keep the pressure on. They're right. Feeling it, okay?
Right.
No, it's now, it's like, you know, do it so much anymore, but you and I remember the basketball fans when you had the full court press.
Right.
You know, challenge them on the throw-in pass. I mean, challenge them at every point because they're confused, they're dazed, they know what's happening to them. They may not be the smartest people in the world, but they do have primitive political survival instincts. They're aware.
Yeah. Yeah, they sure do. James, let me switch to the Republican court. Speaker Hakeem Jeffries called the Supreme Court this week corrupt. Normally I'd say, hey, you know, that's over the top. You can't say that now. I mean, what they've done in the last year, going back to that immunity decision in June of 24, has been partisan and really just terribly dangerous. And this week they basically said, hey, if ICE thugs want to racially profile targets, great. Brown people are suspects. Let's go looking for all the brown people. You know, this is a really dangerous time. And the courts essentially are doing their jobs around the country until you reach the Supreme Court, which acts more like a Trump political action committee. And I think looking ahead, are they going to uphold a judge's decision that the administration has no right to dismiss a Federal Reserve Board member on specious grounds in an effort to control the Fed? Or will they bow to the Don's wishes? Trump's tariffs, which courts have slapped down, are going to be a real dilemma for these Republican judges. I remember Walter Dellinger, the great Walter Dellinger, used to say, you can count on this court to vote with the Republicans. You can count on them to vote with business. But a little bit of a conflict now. Business and Trump are on the different sides of this tariff issue, or many businesses are. So I don't know what they're going to do on that. But I got to tell you, I think the standing of the Supreme Court, the respect for the Supreme Court, is the lowest I've ever seen.
Well, that's undoubtable. And I think both, it's fair to call them corrupt. You look at what Clarence Thomas did. You look at what Alito did. You look at what Gorsuch did. You look again what, John Roberts, his wife, was a headhunter for a law firm that recruited people that practiced before the Supreme Court. I can't imagine a bigger conflict than that. But so the corruption label would hold. But I think more than corrupt, they're just nakedly and aggressively partisan. Mm-hmm. I think when something comes before them, is this good for Trump and the Republican Party? Then we're gonna do it this way. So the idea that you can stop any brown person, I don't know what the fuck that means, okay? And how do you know that they're so into themselves, they think that anybody that's not white is Hispanic. I don't know what. So people of Indonesian, Indian, Brazilians, anybody that's not white, you can stop them without probable cause, with no reason. I mean, I don't know where in the Constitution it says your skin color is probable cause. All right? It's just that in the law around what constitutes probable cause or not is very extensive. It's very, very, there's an extensive body of law, and they just threw it all out. Fuck it.
They did. Kavanaugh claimed, well, that was just one of the factors. Bullshit. That was what they were doing. That's exactly what they were doing. Kavanaugh said, fine, go ahead.
Again, Brett Kavanaugh was the chief leaker in charge of the Ken Starr operation. I'm serious. I mean, they called a Steno Sue Schmidt. That guy leaked more grand jury material in his life than any 10 people. They don't take a case, okay, where they say, well, this is it. They're stopping people, and let's go back and let's study the law. Maybe we need to modify it a little bit. Let's look at the legislative history. Let's look at this. No. They're like, okay, Trump wants to stop anybody based on skin. Okay, fine. Highball. Do it. Put troops in the street. We don't care. Stop who you want. And by the way, Trump, this country was founded on the idea that no person is a king, that there's no one. The very fundamental founding premise of the United States is no one is above the law until the Supreme Court. The first time in our history there exists a person above the law, and that's Donald Trump. He cannot commit a crime acting as president. It's just staggering.
It is, and if they don't understand that they have emboldened him to do all of these awful things. And I guess the answer is, James, as you've said often, they just don't care. They just don't care.
You ever thought that they think it might be in the interest of their political party that there's something like a race war in the United States? Do you think it's possible that in the back of their minds, they're trying to egg this on? I don't know, but their behavior certainly doesn't exclude this possibility.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's a lot of people that think that would be a good idea. We could take care of this problem once and for all.
Yeah. No, I'm afraid you're right. Switching to another really awful subject, Jeffrey Epstein. Trump has been trying to pretend, hey, he hardly even knew this criminal sexual predator, Jeffrey Epstein. And when the Wall Street Journal several weeks ago scooped that Trump actually had sent Epstein, a rather seamy 50th birthday card, Trump said that's untrue, that's a lie, and he sued the Wall Street Journal for, what was it, $10 million or $10 billion? I forget, but it was a high
figure. $10 trillion,
right. This week, guess what? The birthday book came out, and guess what was in it? Trump's greeting to his pal, Epstein. And he signed it, and it was quite seamy. So what does Trump do? He says it's a forgery. They forge his signature. So it's his pattern, James. When charged, deny. When caught, lie. He learned it 40 years ago from Roy Cohn. He practiced it all the time. I mean, I don't think anybody can make a serious case that Trump didn't send that birthday greeting to Jeffrey Epstein. That's fine. But why is he lying about it? What else is he trying to cover up, James?
Because, well, first of all, Albert, you know why he's lying. He lies about everything.
That's true.
Okay, so that's, there's not a single thing that he doesn't lie about. I think one of the things he wrote to Epstein is, quote, we have so much in common.
Yeah, they do. They did.
They do. That's fair enough. Fair enough. But this has got him kind of caught. Because you know he had his hand was in a cookie jar. You know that. He knows that. You know, a lot of kind of Republicans know that. This thing is just, it can't go away. Can't go away. I don't know how hard. And you know, and the Democrats are not overly kicking this, which is probably pretty smart because it's got its own momentum. And you're not going to leave it alone.
Well, it does, except I think the bipartisan Tom Massey Rokana discharge petition to require everything released. You know,
yeah, that's smart.
What this Justice Department and what that James Comer committee, it's selective. They're things they're not going to let out. And right now, with that election in Virginia, they have 218 members, enough to forge the discharge petition when that new member is sworn in. So the question is, who are the people who won't sign it? And I want to check those four Republicans. I don't worry about Tom Massey. I actually don't worry about Marjorie Taylor Greene. But watch Nancy Mace. She's going to be pressured on this. She claims, or I guess she says that she was assaulted sexually. And if she pulls back on this one, she deserves all the criticism we can possibly mount against her. But that discharge petition, James, is close, and it's important.
Yes. And, you know, this is causing them, the combination of, I keep coming back to the rhythm and the timing of politics.
Right.
You know, somebody used to say, remember, you talk about parallel lines all meet in infinity. And somebody said, I never want to go to infinity because I'd just be nothing but parallel lines meeting out there. We're now where we have a confluence of events that are politically enormously benefiting. We're winning every election out there. The economy is going the wrong way. They own it. The Epstein case is just a giant wet blanket on Republican politics all over the country. They have a terrible problem with what the Democrats are going to have to do to just keep the government open. There's a, and you know, I was reading a story in the Times, of course, let me be clear, Times has been very good to me. I like him. But under the story last night, I was reading about the 50-point victory that the Democrat had in Virginia, which is on top of what's happened in Florida and Iowa and God knows where, ever else in the world. Five stories linking to how bad a problem the Democrats have. I can assure you, I'm a Democrat. You vote mostly Democratic. I don't know what party you identify with. You register, but it doesn't matter. Most of the people that listen to this podcast, not all, we're glad to have anybody, for Democrat, let me tell you, we are approaching summer. I just got to tell you, I know, and I wrote that we were discombobulated. We're not January anymore. We're not in March anymore. We're in a different season.
Yep.
We got to understand that.
Yep.
And they can keep having all the panel discussions they want. Oh, the registration is down. Everybody hates them. But it may be true, but what we do know is we're winning elections. Now, if we're not winning them for who we are, but who they are, that's fine with me because we get a presidential nominee we're going to be able to get a better definition to who we are. I don't give a shit why you vote for us. Okay, you can vote for us because you like us, or you can vote for us because you hate us more than him, but a vote's a vote.
Yeah, sure is. And, you know, if the Democrats hang tough and do well and win this fight over government funding, win maybe double-digit victories in Virginia and New Jersey this November, that paves, and also win a big victory in the California redistricting referendum, that paves the way for those midterms. And that's going to make Republicans, A, it's going to make them very nervous. It's going to create some real fissures. They won't know what to do. It's their district versus their total fealty to Trump. And you're going to get more retirements. And you're going to and any place where you haven't recruited a candidate yet, it's going to be better, a lot easier to recruit a good Democratic candidate. I just would note one, in that district in Scranton, Pennsylvania, it used to be that the Democrats thought, well, that's the one Republican seat. They beat a Democrat last time. It's going to be hard to take back. And this guy, incumbent, has gotten in trouble. And then the Scranton mayor, she announced and put out one of the great opening ads I've ever seen. And I think that seat's gone from, you know, I don't know, likely Republican to maybe a toss-up.
We're just not losing elections.
Right.
Okay, and I don't think we're going to lose that congressional. I have to look at it. I'm obviously familiar with Northeast Pennsylvania. We're just not losing. And I don't think we're going to. By the way, when you think about the Virginia race, and I'm getting more and more thinking the New Jersey race is here, it's hard to imagine a ceiling. It's really hard for me to figure out how Spanberger wins by less than double digits.
Yeah.
Then again, if you look what happened in Virginia 11, then they're just totally demoralized. And they're running on bathrooms. Literally, that's what the guy in Virginia 11th closed zone, that's what Sears is talking about.
The gubernatorial candidate for the GOP.
Right, right, gubernatorial candidate. In a big thing, American Bridge, thank you, full disclosure, I'm associated with him, I paid by him, got Citarelli, who is the Republican candidate in New Jersey, at a Republican fundraiser, saying he wanted to have a 10% across-the-board sales tax. Bye-bye, Jack.
Oh, yeah.
You think that's going to get, you know tax policy well enough to know sales tax crushes middle and lower income people. And that's dominating the news cycle in New Jersey.
Well, and they want it, of course, so they can lower the income taxes for their wealthy contributors. Right. That's what it's all about.
Short hills.
James, did you get a chance to read that piece I sent you this morning, the Atlantic excerpt of Kamala Harris's book?
Oh man. There's part of me that feels sorry for the whole 2024 experience. But she's not going out. Her exit is not very glorious, I have to tell you. Explain to people what her point is. And by the way, this is the most critical Joe Biden Democratic leaning podcast ever, but explain to our listeners exactly what her point is.
Yeah, she makes some points that I agree with, but it'll be a very important condition in a minute. She said that the decision for Biden to run again was reckless. It was reckless. And she says others should have stopped him. And I give her a little bit of credit. She said, I was in the worst position to go and stop him because I would have been the beneficiary. Great, I agree with that. She said there were staff constantly undercut her, the Biden staff. Well, maybe they did. He picked her. I mean, I'm sorry. She didn't just suddenly show up and they may have been some criticisms that were unfair, but a vice president can leave a footprint and she didn't. But where she really falls down, and she didn't address it here, is once she got that nomination, I mean, why? And she was a mediocre candidate. She should have broken with Biden and selective issues, the cost of living and the border at the Chicago convention. She did not. She never did. And she carried that albatross all the way to Election Day. And now she says, he wasn't. She doesn't say he was unfit to serve. She said he was unfit to run again. And also, I think she should have picked Josh Shapiro, obviously, instead of Tim Walz. But the fact is that they both did not acquit themselves well, and it's going to go down as a sad chapter in Democratic political history.
You know, I think it's fair to say that she was an okay presidential candidate. I mean, she had these restrictions on what she could say and not say. And,
but they were self-imposed.
I agree. No, I said she was a fair
candidate.
She's been an awful post-presidential election person.
Yeah.
I mean, just awful. And all of the questions you have, the border, which, oh, by the way, she was, whether she was or not, she was supposedly the border czar. All right?
Well, she really wasn't, but she got hit with that.
We'll talk about this some. That she was urged to make crime her signature issue when she took office back in January of 2021. And they were so intimidated by the left and so enamored by it, the answer was, and I know this is true, please don't deny it, okay? They said, we just can't do that. And now you look at David Kennedy in the New York Times, you look around the country in the massive decrease in crime that took place under Joe Biden, and we didn't get a single goddamn vote for it.
Right.
And we should have been out front of it.
Yeah.
Not a single one.
So I guess my hope is that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris find nice places to go back to. They can give speeches if they want to. Biden can build his library at the University of Delaware. Harris can do some things in California. But you know something? Your time is gone as far as Democratic national politics. So just stay away.
Anybody that had anything to do with 2024, I've been with donors all week. They don't even want to hear about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not Harris, not Waltz, not anybody. Nothing. They just so want to move on. Maybe it's unjustified. Life is unfair. You know, people have like come back from defeats before, but I don't think this one is. I think the country just moved way beyond all of this.
Totally agree.
Wine is something that I actually know something about. I happen to be drinking some right here on the show because it takes the edge off of me. And what these guys do is they go out and find, they taste stuff all the time that you can't taste, you won't taste, and they find it at ridiculous price. It's literally not even $7 a bottle.
You know, you can get paralyzed going to, you know, wine store and try to figure options and prices, but you now can get exactly what you want and you can ditch that store for good, all thanks to Naked Wines. We love that they're a sponsor of this podcast, and you will too. As soon as you show up to summer parties or a romantic dinner for those single people with a chilled bottle of an amazing vintage from a unique and storied independent winemaker from Naked Wines, you're going to be an instant hit. By now, you know that we love wine, and there's nothing better than a nice glass after a long day with friends or family. Naked Wines will have the perfect bottle for you at any moment, as James said, at great prices. Again, this podcast is sponsored by Naked Wines. It's a wine club that directly connects you to the world's best independent winemakers, so you can get world-class wine delivered straight to your door. Plus, you can use our code WARROOM for the code and password at nakedwines.com and get six bottles for just $39.99. You think I made a mistake? You think you can't get six bottles for $39.99, less than $7 a bottle? Oh, yes, you can at Naked Wines. Plus, Naked Wines helps you take any meal to the next level with the perfect bottle for any occasion. Thanks to Naked Wines, you can share an amazing fettuccine dish paired with a 2021 Chris Kondo's Organic Mendocino Chardonnay. It's a dinner to remember. And the best part, every bottle is a passion project from an independent winemaker. So you are literally making their business dreams come true. So the question is, how do they do it? Naked Wines brings you amazing, straight from the winery, up to 60% less than what you would pay in a store. You cut out the extra costs, like the middleman markups, and those winemakers can pass the savings on to you, without skimping on quality. Now's the time to join the Naked Wines community. Head to nakedwines.com/war room. Click enter voucher and put in code war room for both the code and password for 6 bottles of wine for $39.99 with shipping included. That's $100 off your first 6 bottles at nakedwines.com/war room when you use the code and password war room for 6 bottles of wine for $39.99. The link is in our show notes.
Go find a $6.50 glass of wine at the Olive Garden. You can't. All right. So let's say you're a young person. You're just a person of modest means, or you're a very frugal person, but you like to entertain. Get these 6 wines. Go get a pre-made charcuterie tray. You can get them anywhere now. It's or something. And invite 3 couples over, you know, some 5 friends, and do like a flight tasting. All right, we'll start, and you can start with, you know, they generally start with a lighter white first, end up with a more robust red at the end. They open up a conversation about it. I'm telling you, the shit is going to be good. You can throw a hell of a party. Enjoy your night with Naked Wines.
Hey, James, David Lynch, prominent economic correspondent for The Washington Post, has written a very important and really troubling book on the failure of economic globalism, The World's Worst Bet. Everybody out there ought to get it. The World's Worst Bet. David, 30 years ago, I can recall the exuberant optimism. Cold War is over. Communism is an anachronism. A new globalism, premium on free markets, political liberalism, just a whole new world order. Didn't really work out, did it?
Well, I would say it didn't work out as well as it might have. And what was the problem was really our response to it. It was liken it to buying a sexy new sport car with a great red paint job on it, can go real fast down the highway. But we forgot to get the airbags and the seat belts and the headlights and all the stuff you need to make sure you don't end up in a ditch by the side of the road. So globalization, as Bill Clinton said all the time, is a fact, not a choice. And he was right about that. He warned also that it would create winners and losers. He was right about that. But the way it was supposed to work was that the winners were supposed to use some of their gains to provide for the losers, to make sure that we all enjoyed the benefits. And that part never happened.
You know, a big part of your book is about China. And the important assumption that was made back then was that by embracing China, bringing them into the World Trade Organization, creating an economic relationship with them, that they would open up. They would build on Deng Xiaoping's economic reforms, embrace free markets and political liberalism. That certainly didn't work out.
Well, certainly not from the vantage point of today or even the last 10 years. I moved to China about 6 months after they joined the WTO. And when I lived there, I and my family, it did seem, as I say in the book, it was an attractive theory. And for a while, it seemed like it might even be true. I remember being on the campus of Beijing University, one of the country's premier centers of higher education, and talking to young Chinese students. And they couldn't care less about membership in the Communist Party. Back in those days, they all wanted to go out and get jobs and start businesses and get rich. And the country was opening up, and they did a tremendous amount of economic reform and complied with a lot of the onerous requirements associated with joining the World Trade Organization. But that eventually petered out, and it petered out before Xi Jinping. People like to sort of use Xi's coming to power in 2012 as a line of demarcation between when things were going okay and then when things went off the rails. It actually started before that, under his colorless predecessor, Hu Jintao. The turn toward doubling down on state control of the economy and the loss of momentum behind some of the economic reform, that all started in the late 2000s.
David, I'm going to pick up on something you said earlier, that Clinton and others said that with this free trade, expanded trade, there will be winners and there will be losers. And you certainly chronicle very well those people who really were hurt by this. But I think most of these deals, including NAFTA, there were more winners than losers. But to the winners, it was one of many issues. To the losers, it was the only issue. And secondly, we didn't do enough to help the losers. Bob Rubin told you retraining could work. We never gave it what was required. It wasn't that NAFTA was bad. It was our follow-through was bad.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the process of trade liberalization and addition of NAFTA and the entry of China into the global trading system, that all benefited us. I want to be quite clear about on that point. I'm not anti-globalization, far from it. I mean, my life has benefited from it in countless ways. But the benefits were spread across the entire economy like frosting on a cake. We all got some of it. And the losses were concentrated like economic tumors among specific groups of people in specific types of communities. And for them, it was, you know, it was a zero-sum thing. If you were working in a tire plant in Union City, Tennessee, you had a pretty good job there at the Goodyear plant. That was hot, exhausting, dirty work, but it was the best-paying job around. You could make, with overtime, maybe six figures if you were lucky. And then Chinese imports, along with automation and some mistakes by management and labor together, those jobs disappear. And when those jobs disappear, you can't find anything that pays remotely that well in that area. So you end up with your income cut in half, or you're driving 500 miles to another plant somewhere, seeing your family once or twice a month. You know, these are real costs in real people's lives. And, you know, over time that accumulated. Many of these same people got the short end of the stick in the global financial crisis, also exacerbated by globalization. And ultimately, those resentments built up.
David, I'm going to pick up on something you said. You had a really interesting conversation last year with Bill Clinton, who was the architect of some of this. Tell us about it and tell us about his views on this.
Yeah, it was. I mean, he's a fascinating guy to talk to today, as he was 30 or 40 years ago. And he's very thoughtful on these issues. And he acknowledges right out, I put it to him and I said, you know, I think this whole bargain that we promised, starting with Bill Clinton, but certainly not limited to him, it was repeated for years. You know, we never kept that promise to people who were in danger of being left behind. The least educated, the folks with the fewest skills in the society. And he said, I agree with that. And Gene Sperling, one of his top economic aides over the years, said, you know, he thinks Clinton recognizes that we should have married the needed domestic reforms to create a better social safety net and provide retraining, relocation assistance, additional support for folks. We should have married that with the trade liberalization at the time, instead of assuming it was going to happen in sequence, because for various political reasons, you know, later never came.
Well, they said they were going to do that, and then the 94 election ended any possibility of that.
Yep. But, you know, the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program, which has been around since JFK started in 1962, has always been an afterthought. It was created as kind of a political bargaining chip to get trade liberalization through Congress back in the early 60s. It was always underfunded. Nobody took it seriously. Labor regarded it as burial insurance. The corporate community didn't want to pay for it. And so it was always, you know, just enough to get the deal over the finish line, never enough to really make a difference in people's lives.
James.
So David, first of all, this is a really important book. And unfortunately, I've read parts of it, and it's just really well done. Two points I want to ask you about. First of all, we hate alternative history. All right. What if the Confederates won Gettysburg? Or what if they didn't work? What if the Supreme Court didn't steal the 2000 election?
because it is my theory, just so you know, I'm not asking you to agree or disagree with me, that was the beginning of the end. I think if Gore would have gotten elected, this isn't perfect, but I think he would have tried to accomplish some of the retraining and adjustments and whatever that you needed to make. Am I wrong or crazy or what?
You know, I'm not sure. You may well be right, because the Bush administration was fundamentally uninterested from an ideological perspective, both in the first term and in the second term, in doing anything about the downsides of globalization. Hank Paulson, at one point in the second term, tried to argue for doing more, and George Bush shot him down and said the existing, matter of fact, in an interview with me at the time with USA Today, he said, you know, the existing programs are adequate. But in terms of alternative history, James, I'll go you one better. Al Gore may well have won in 2000 if we had done a better job of regulating global capital flows in the 1990s, because you remember the Asian financial crisis that led to a flood of cheap steel coming in from Korea, Russia, and other places.
I remember the peso crisis too.
Right, but the Asian crisis is important, and Bill Clinton recognized it. That put six major steel producers into bankruptcy in the U.S. Among the places hit hard was Weirton, West Virginia. And West Virginia was one of a handful of states that had gone for Bill Clinton in 92 and 96, and that Gore lost. And Clinton told Taylor Branch, his biographer, that if the steel workers in Weirton blamed the Clinton administration for their troubles, which Clinton thought they were wrong about, but it was the perception nonetheless. And if the steel industry there had not been so hard hit, Gore may well have won West Virginia. And if he had, he would have won the election, hanging chads or no hanging chads.
Okay, so David, I'll turn to Alan, go a little bit, because God eternalized life through our experiences. So the early 70s, I'm in LSU Law School. There's one black and three females. Everybody that graduated got a job. I mean, you might get a shit job in some North Louisiana parish as an ADA, but you got a job. My tuition was $130 a semester. I got $300 tax-free every month from the GI Bill. And I bought 1972, I saved up, and I bought a Toyota Corolla. You know why? Because I had an Oldsmobile, and it was a bucket of boat. Okay? They just were making better products. I mean, we got to acknowledge that. And I didn't know about globalization. I really didn't, barely had heard of BMW or Sony. Then Price LeBlanc, a guy I knew from back home, was selling Toyotas. And he said, this is a really good car. I paid $2,100 for it. Fucking thing lasted for 8 years. Weren't they just making better products at one time than we were? And people just were seeking them out. I mean, we weren't making as good of cars as they were.
No, absolutely. I mean, look, I've got two Japanese nameplate cars in my garage right at the moment. One Toyota, one Honda. One of them was made in Mexico. One of them was made in Mississippi. So
yeah, my Bronco was made in Mexico, by the way.
Right. So my home is an emblem of globalization. So yeah, and again, to me the failure was not to open up and compete with the world. We've got to do that. I don't think we have any choice about that. And Bill Clinton, was always very eloquent about the fact that, you know, a lot of this global competition was happening one way or the other, whether we did these deals or not. You can't put up, despite our current best efforts, you can't put up gigantic walls around the United States and make it entirely self-sufficient. It's not going to work. It's not going to be efficient. It's not going to be productive. We'd all be poorer for it. But, you know, to me, there were a number of things that what I refer to as the globalization gamble, where we were focused on the upsides of globalization, and we didn't pay sufficient policy attention to the downsides, which include the issue we're talking about with the disaffected workers, but also include supply chains that became overly concentrated in China, global capital flows that were all but unregulated because that's what was in vogue at the time. And we were slow to recognize that despite what we assumed the geopolitical effects of trade would be, the Chinese Communist Party was intent on hanging on to both its authoritarian political system and its non-market economic system.
Well, it seems to have succeeded for now. I mean, I think they're somewhat trouble. Turn it back to Al. I think you did a great book. I'll pick one bone with the title. I know you got to have a title that grabs people. I buy that. Okay. I think the more accurate title was Globalization, a Necessary but Unfulfilled Promise.
Right. I wouldn't argue with that language, but I don't think it would move the merchandise.
No, it would. I do. We're right there wrong. I'm a big believer in our other book called An Aussie Road In. Okay. I understand provocative titles, but I think it was going to happen if we did the WTO or NAFTA or whatever. People were going to buy it.
No question. No question. Just like, you know, we were going to buy that car I'm talking about, and you can drive it without airbags and without seatbelts, and it'll work for a while, but it's not going to work as well.
On one premise, the steak is really good. The sizzle is a little off, but that's okay. You buy the meal to eat the steak.
James, your title may be great, but you can't put it on a T-shirt. David, the response today, which Trump personifies, is economic nationalism. Really, basically, kind of go it alone with heavy tariffs if they're upheld. It may sound like a good, quick political fix, but that's not going to bring back any of those jobs in Ohio and those places that you described in the book, is it, David?
Well, two things. The short answer to your question is very, very unlikely. Any economist will tell you, you know, manufacture, just as we moved from an agricultural economy to an industrial economy, we're in the process and have been for decades moving from an industrial economy to a more services-based economy. And there's just a sort of iron law of economic logic to these things, largely because of automation. We don't need as many people on the farms to produce the food we need, and we don't need as many people in the factories as we once did to produce the stuff we need. And that's going to continue to happen. Now, can you affect it at the margin if you spend enough money and if you change the rules of the economy? Sure, but it's going to cost you a lot. It's going to be less efficient than the other way of doing it. And, you know, historically, this has happened to every advanced economy. It's happening to China. China's manufacturing workforce is coming down as they go through the early stages of this process themselves. So, you know, we're not alone in that.
Let me turn to the Democrats for a second. I think two of the smartest policy Democrats are Larry Summers, a former Treasury Secretary, and Jake Sullivan, the former National Security Advisor. They really sharply disagree in a way about where we're going. What does it say about that debate within the Democratic Party on this issue?
Yeah, it's very much. I mean, first of all, you're entirely right about both of them, and I think the debate is entirely unresolved at the moment. There were a lot of people I think of as sort of globalization purists or traditionalists who thought with the first Trump administration, okay, this is awful, this is the end of the world, but we'll just hang on for 4 years, and then the adults will come back, and we'll get back to the world of pre-2016. Everything will be okay. And that's how they felt when Biden got in at first. They thought, okay, great. We're going to get back to doing more NAFTA-style deals, more trade liberalization. Happy days will be here again. But Biden didn't do that. Biden's trade policy looked a lot more like Donald Trump's than Bill Clinton's. And Jake Sullivan gave an important speech at Brookings, I think it was April of 23, where he laid out their theory of the case, which, you know, there was a lot of overlap between the Biden-Sullivan theory of the case and the Trump theory. The Jake's version was, you know, had a little more intellectual gloss on it than Donald Trump's typically does, which boils down to, you know, foreigners are being unfair to us. But, you know, and Larry was not a fan of that speech and went to see Jake in the White House at one point to talk about it. And Jake's view of it was Larry's real concern was that, you know, Sullivan and Biden's approach made enough sense that it was going to catch on and that it was going to be sort of the end of the policies that Larry had favored when he was in office.
Well, I mean, just a quick addition. I got one more question to ask you. There were certainly similarities to Trump, but they weren't, you know, the Sullivan-Biden theory is not go it alone. They believe in relationships and alliances economically and politically, which Trump really disparages.
Sure, but Biden left in place just about all of Trump's tariffs and added some more tariffs of his own and pursued no trade liberalization agreements at all in the 4 years he was there. So that's the similarity.
David, James is so right. This is a really important and a really, really good book. I'm glad it's coming out now. It's not beach reading, so I'm glad the beach season is over, but it certainly is library reading. You document how the trade pacts caused disruptions and clearly hurt some people. There are smart people I know who believe that this is going to look like a ripple compared to the tsunami of disruptions that artificial intelligence might well cause. That may make that really is going to be a big deal over the next 10 or 15 years, and a lot of people are going to be hurt. Are they alarmist?
Honestly, it's hard to know. The estimates are all over the map. I would say that the prospects of what AI is doing, what you hear from some people in the labor market is that it's already having an impact on the job prospects of new college graduates, and that potentially it could really decimate employment prospects for a lot of white-collar workers, which would be different from the China shock, which hit blue-collar workers almost exclusively. But this, to me, underscores the importance of learning the lessons of the period I write about in The World's Worst Bet. Because, you know, some people say, well, look, the China shock's over, so what's the point? There's nothing we can do about it. Sure, fair enough. We can't go back in time and make things right. But this is not going to be the last profound economic shock that hits the American worker. And our social safety net is just about as flimsy today as it was when China first came on the scene. So looking ahead to the effect of something like artificial intelligence, I think it'd be a good idea if the government started experimenting with some policies, wage insurance, more place-based strategies, perhaps a number of things. I'm not wedded to any one particular item, but the fact is there is a quite serious prospect that there's going to be profound change coming down the pike, and we ought to get our ducks in a row now to deal with it rather than bemoan it when it happens.
James, you want to close this out?
I do, David. I'm glad I have this with you because you've been around a long time. I think the essence of being a Clinton Democrat, which I am, it could be summed up, is an almost childlike reverence for job training or education. That we, if we could just train enough people, you know, and it's almost like if you talk to a Clinton person, they would tell you that Mississippi State is a more important university than Brown. Okay, that's the essence of, you know, I know these guys, and the conversation inevitably comes back to if we just trained enough people sufficiently, we gave enough people the skills, then we would be fine, and the other stuff would all fall in place. And I'm pretty sure I'm right about that. This is only 30, 40 years of experience with it. But every conversation, and you spent a long time with President Clinton when you did this book, as any good reporter do. You know, he was a central figure in this. You certainly were talked to him. Do you get the sense that that we can train our way out of anything we want? I think that's at the core of who we are.
Yeah, I think you're right. The job training has been a key part of things. You know, Bob Rice talks about it. Larry Katz, back in the midst of the NAFTA debate, came close to getting something done. You know, to my mind, I talk about the GI Bill as an example of what the American government can do when it puts its mind to it. Because, you know, I would have had a poorer life but for the GI Bill, because my dad, who fought in the war, went off to, you know, had no prospects of going to college when he went off to the war. He was working in a machine shop, and he was expecting to work in a machine shop when he got back. But the government passes this tremendous life-changing legislation. He goes and spends 4 years at Fordham, changes his life trajectory, and as a consequence, changes mind. And it changed the lives of millions of American servicemen and their families. And it, you know, we've kind of gotten in the habit, I think, this is kind of an editorial comment, I suppose.
Oh, go ahead.
Where everything's too hard. You can't do anything and everything costs too much and all the obstacles are, you know, 10 feet high. We'll never get anything done. And, you know, there are things that we can put our mind to. And if we prioritize it, and that was part of the problem with addressing the China shock, you know, there was always some other priority that seemed more important at the time, whether it was deficit cutting, the war in Iraq, a desire for good relations with a rising China. Something was always more important than dealing with these labor market issues. And right. I think one of the lessons that I lay out in the book is that if you leave these sort of resentments and dissatisfaction out in the country long enough, it metastasizes into something that has gotten us where we are today. And, you know, I think a lot of Americans would say if it had cost a little bit of money back in 2000, 2005, 2010 to avoid where we've ended up, boy, I would happily have paid that.
Thank you, David. I am a direct beneficiary of the GI Bill. So you can't say enough nice about it to me. I got $300 a month in 1971 dollars. Yep. Do what the shit you want. The GI Bill didn't pay tuition of books. They just gave you money.
Yeah.
Literally, they just you could do what you want. You go to French Quarter, get drunk. You could hire a tutor. You could buy your textbooks. You could whatever you want. You could buy your girlfriend dinner. But boy, it educated a lot of people, and your dad and myself being one of them. Thank you, man.
Yep, changed lives.
Other than the GI Bill and family, I guess, David, the most important thing in your life was working for me, right?
Oh, you know, that goes without saying, Al. You know, surviving that experience has made me the man I am today.
You like an Al Hunt alum? That's who's who. You know, they have the 3 degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon. I'd like to go to every experienced journalist and have 3 degrees of separation from Al Hunt.
I will tell you, I don't know how much he benefited, but when at Bloomberg, we were just starting to walk. We learned to crawl, and David Lynch was a superstar and made a huge difference. And yeah. He has written a fabulous book. David, thank you so much. I want everybody out there to, you know, try to get a copy of this book and read it. And it's whatever that you think of the title, it's a book that everyone ought to read.
Don't judge this book by its cover.
Yes.
I like the cover.
All yes, right. Okay, I'll look.
You should see some of the covers we rejected. I like this cover.
great effort, David. Congratulations on a tremendous effort.
Thanks a million.
Very fair book, by the way, I might add.
Thank you. That's what I'm aiming for. I doubt I'll make anybody completely happy, but this is my honest take on what went down.
Oh, I cannot tell you, having written a little bit about it and having directed two bureaus that covered it, I learned so much in that book. So thank you. It's a terrific book.
Thank you.
Thanks a million, guys.
Let me tell you, I'm experiences today. I don't want to pick on any particular airline, but I fly a lot. But I had, trying to get back, I had delays, God knows what not. I got into Dulles 3 hours late. I had to come out to Shenandoah County. Of course, I drank too much, but that's what happens when you have delays. I got 5 hours sleep, and I woke up feeling like crap. And I took one of those goddamn things, and I got to tell you, I'm better. I'm a little sluggish, but without Z-Biotics, I could have done the show, but I couldn't have done it. I'd have been not near as good as I am now.
That's good. And next time, take it before those 5 drinks. You know, carry it with you. Because, you know, after a night with drinks, you don't bounce back like we used to. It used to be a big decision.
Dead cat bounce.
Oh, my God. Do you want to have a great night or a great next day? Luckily, with pre-alcohol, you don't have to compromise anymore. I'm going to just tell you what it's about. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's the buildup of the byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make pre alcohol your first drink of the night. James is going to now remember that. Drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. Thanks to Z-Biotics, James even goes on long runs after his long nights every time you have Z-Biotics pre-alcohol before a drink. It makes such a difference. Whether you're writing all day, exercising, or even going in front of an audience, Z-Biotics is our MVP when it counts. Imagine how great it will feel to wake up ready to take on the next day after long dinners or watching the game with friends. After all, fall is right around the corner, so that means it's time to raise a glass to your favorite team, whether you're tailgating, enjoying a college game day, or watching Sunday action on that fancy new TV. Don't forget, Z-Biotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. Drink a pre-alcohol before drinking and enjoy great days after celebrating all season long. Go to zbiotics.com/PWR to learn more and get 15% off your first order when you use PWR at checkout. Zbiotics is back with 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to zbiotics.com/PWR and use the code PWR at checkout for 15% off. The link also is in our show notes.
Get back on your game with Z-Biotics.
Hey, now, James, for the outrage of the week. Donald Trump went out for dinner the other night, a few blocks from the White House, surrounded by his security agents. With him were Vice President Vance and his security agents, Defense Secretary Hegseth and his security agents, Secretary of State Rubio and his security agents, along with support from D.C. police. He boasted, "Look how safe this city is since I sent in the troops." Oh, really, Donald? That's why it's so safe, two blocks from the White House, surrounded by hordes of security agents. But let me give you another vantage point, thanks to a story in the Washington Post. Tamika Austin runs a convenience store in Northeast Washington, where a gang of young thugs ransacked and stole thousands of dollars of merchandise. She was on local television, and she called for help from the community, and she said, "You know, I'll take help from Trump." So the White House called her and said, "Reinforcements are on the way." They arrived. It wasn't security or wasn't police. It was cameras to record her for White House propaganda use. She refused to go along. She said, "They want to use me to put out a story to use it as an excuse to send more troops in to harass people." That's what Trump is doing. It's performative. It has very little to do with long-term crime prevention.
Okay, thank you. I've been to Joe's in Washington,
I don't know, 25 times. I've never had a second thought about walking to it or going there or anything else. I used to go to one, I went to one in Miami. When you go to Joe's, get the stone crabs, the hash browns, and a cold fork. Everything else after that, they do it very well. They replicated one in Chicago, they have one in Washington. It's a South Miami Beach, legendary place.
But the one in Washington, James, you weren't fearful?
I never thought about it. It was a kind of, like a lot of my friends, it was one of our kind of three go-to places. Yeah. I guarantee you I've been there 25 times. Yeah. I have never thought, and it's right middle of downtown. I mean, when you go to Tosca, Joe Stonecraft, I never heard of anybody, I never heard of a female saying, "Can you walk me back to my car?" Okay, never, ever, not one time that I have, not at certain parts of, I wouldn't go hanging out in certain parts of D.C. at 2:30 in the morning, but that's not the question. It's all full of shit. So my outrage kind of builds on yours. There was a piece in the New York Times today by a guy named David Kennedy, who's on the faculty of John Jay College, which is the Harvard, MIT, Oxford, Cambridge of policing. And what people need to understand is we basically know how to solve the problem of violent crime. not totally, but when I tell you 75%, I'm not exaggerating. And Kennedy points out today the dramatic decrease in urban crime that has taken place. Now, somebody that's running for president has to explain to the public how this is done. So I know this, Cole. So let's say you have a city of 500,000 people. Of that city of 500,000 people, there's maybe 1,000, let's say 1,100 to just be generous, who are going to commit 85% of the crimes. We know that. Through technology, we can know their names. All right, know that. There's a small subset of people that are going to overwhelmingly commit a majority of the crimes in the country. And you can know their names. Now, it gets difficult. And you don't have to even, you can do neighborhood arrest records, dropout. There's like 6 to 7 criteria, and they spell out the name. So what they would do, and they did it, is they would show up at your house, knock on the door and say, partner, you got 3 choices. All right. You can go to the community college and learn a skill. This is a bus ticket out of town, or don't make an illegal left turn. What that is targeting. Understand that. And although it does not even need a racial component to spit the names out, but I got to be honest, as you can imagine, they're going to be a disproportionate number of, let's just say, non-white people. Leave it at that. All right? I think the country has to have a discussion about this, because it does make some people uncomfortable. I can understand that. But we can do this. It is absolutely doable. They do it in Baltimore. They do it in Oakland. They're doing it everywhere. Now, they're not going to tell you that that's what they're doing, but that's exactly what they're doing. And I think at some point, okay, fine, but at some point you got to level with people and say, this is the price of order. And I think people are willing to accept that. And I think people are willing to accept the fact that if you take someone who you believe is likely to commit violent crimes and try to intervene, and that's what this is, that's intervening to try to stop them from doing this, we should do that. But we in order to do this properly, you got to have public support and public understanding. And it has to come from within the communities. You got to go to community town hall and say, I know and you know 10 people here that if you see them coming down the street, you're going to the other side of the street. They know that. They don't need a algorithm to tell them that. They already know that. But we have to level with people, and we know how to do this. It can be done. And it can be done, I think, in a way that can really help people. I really do. I'm very passionate on this issue. I've lived with it.
Well, you know, James, we ought to either get Mr. Kennedy or remember that great University of
Pittsburgh. We should get both of them.
That University of Pittsburgh law professor who made the same point.
We could do both of them.
Right. Okay.
And the truth of the matter is, I'm just blurt this out, but I mean it, and I thought it before I said it. They don't want to solve the problem.
They being the Trump people.
I mean the Trump people.
Right.
Okay. If you said there's a magical way that we could reduce, quote, urban crime, unquote, we all know what that means. I don't have to explain it to you. They wouldn't take it. They don't want the solution. They want the fucking issue. All right? The
solution is right. It's all performative. It's all performative.
But let's get Kennedy. Let's get our friend from the Pitt Law School, and he can do the what's the legality of this?
Right.
You know, because it does make people uncomfortable that technology can spit out a name on its own. This is a person of interest. But it's basically right. We need to do that.
We'll do that.
Valuable contribution.
Hopefully for next week. It sure would be.
I'm happy to. I'm obsessed with this issue.
All right, now for our questions from the best, most learned, smartest, insightful listeners in the country. And we'll start off with Laura in Raleigh, North Carolina, one of my favorite towns. She says she's heard that Democrats must respond to the moment by taking bold action, doing bold things that may not be comfortable, taking risks. James, what bold things should they be doing?
I love Raleigh. This woman is very, that's very funny. When you don't have power, you can't do anything bold. The bold thing you can do is win elections.
Right.
Okay. It's the hardest thing to, some people understand is, why do we do this? Why do we do that? We can't do anything. We don't have power. You want to do bold things? Do what they did in Virginia 11. Do what they did in the Iowa 1st Senate Congressional District. Do what they did in Florida. Vote and vote to do bold things. But right now, that's so bold. We don't have any power. But what the hell we can do? And sometimes in life, it's important, if you want to fulfill your expectations, at some point, you got to acknowledge your limitations at another point. And that's where we are.
Yeah. Absolutely. Bob in Princeton, New Jersey, says to us, let's stop talking about the presidency. The real battle is for 2026. Right on, Bob. You could not. You're absolutely right. Look, I don't care how Gavin Newsom is running against Pete Buttigieg or anyone else. I think there's a lot of great possibilities out there, including Andy Beshear. I don't rule out Wes Moore, despite what he said the other day. But that's in the future. The real battle is for 2026. And if Democrats don't take back the House, it's going to be the worst disaster in a midterm election in our lifetime. And they've got a chance to take back the Senate, too. So you're right. You know, starting November, whenever it is, 7th or 5th of 2026, you can start worrying about 2028.
I've just got one little mild disagreement with you. Sometimes we do. The most important election you face is the next one. It's the one you face with. And right now, and I think you do agree with me, Virginia and New Jersey are ultimately critical because they will determine momentum, fundraising, recruitment, any number of things that are going to affect the 2026 outcome.
I do agree with you, and I would add the California redistricting referendum is being critical too.
I would agree with that. But what you got to know is political consultants just look, you know, they say a statesman looks to the next generation, a politician looks to the next election, and a political hack looks at the next tracking poll. Okay, we don't have a very long horizon. Yeah. but I think here we can. You know, my belief is politics is sequential. One event influences another event. And I cannot contain, and I may have to just eat crow. I've done it before. After the elections coming up in this November, but I think we're going to do very, very well.
Yeah. James Stephen in Palm Springs, California, says, if Pete Hegseth is now Secretary of War, does that mean the office of Secretary of Defense is vacant?
So thank you. I used to go to Palm Springs when I was in the Marine Corps. It's very wealthy, okay, particularly in 8 months out of the year. I was out there a year and a half ago. I always have a great time when I do that. You know, interestingly, the symbol of the Defense Department is the eagle. And in one hand, the eagle holds the olive branch of peace, and the other hand holds the arrows of war. And when they changed it to the Defense Department, the eagle used to look toward the arrows of war. They changed the eagle's vision to the olive branch of peace. A pretty interesting thing. And in one sense, it doesn't matter. In another sense, there have been some great secretaries of defense. I mean, some real fucking patriots. You could name five off the top of your head. You probably knew five, okay? And the fact that this petty-ass cable TV drunk jock, well, he's not a jock, it's jock sniffer, is running one of the most storied departments of any government anywhere in the world I just can't digest it. And they're going around and talking about fucking changing the name from war to defense. What are they naming, worshiping the Confederacy, which was nothing but a pack of goddamn traitors? And you just can't allow yourself to delve into a pit of bitterness. But let me tell you one thing, Secretary Hedgepeth, there are people that vote in the Pentagon, and they are a lot. Most of them are traditional Republicans. Let's just say that the people that work in the five rings are expected to vote 72% Republican. They're going to clock in about 52%. Watch it. These guys are going to take their vengeance out on you at the ballot box. And trust me, you want one thing to remember. In a special election in the Florida 1st Congressional District, the first time, I don't know, since the 70s, a Democrat carried Escambia County, Florida. I explain it to you. That's the extreme western county of the Florida Panhandle, and it's nothing but Navy people. They are not happy with you, Pete. You don't have support in the building. You better watch your back because they're after you. Just give you a little warning here. Watch out. You're not popular.
Yeah, I would just tell Stephen, who asked, does that mean the Office of Secretary of Defense is vacant? Stephen, it's been vacant since January 20th, 2025, whatever you name it, because they have a vacant, totally unqualified secretary.
Trump. Cable TV jock.
Yeah, yeah.
Is running the place that, you know, the story departments and government anywhere in the world is a disgrace.
Yeah. You know, Linda in Carbondale, Colorado asks, do we need more qualifications for people to serve in Congress? She's thinking of Lauren Boebert. There are some eminently unqualified people in the United States Congress, more so than any time that I can remember, but no, we don't need more qualifications. It's up to the voters. We need voters to express their will more. You people, Colorado is such a great state, and I'm not totally sure how Boebert's new district, she had to move to a new district, but she was going to lose in her old one, how that's structured. But, you know, put up a good candidate against her at least. But no, we don't want any more new qualifications.
You know, I'm so political and cynical. If we got to have a Republican district in Colorado, I'm sure we do. We probably should. Eastern part of the state is heavily Republican. There's no one I'd rather have than Lauren Boebert.
You've always been a big Beetlejuice fan, James. So
she and Green, and with Nancy Mace is to be determined. I think this stuff with Epstein at some level, and I never thought I'd say this, I think it does offend, and I certainly can understand why. I think they're genuinely offended by this.
I totally agree with you.
I never thought that
I softened my views
anything that I thought
2 minutes ago.
You know, it wasn't performative, but you know, she's probably like a lot of women. You know, you talk to women, we don't just realize how prevalent this kind of stuff is. And it's not just prevalent in Hollywood and Wall Street. Man, it's prevalent in the stock room at the Dollar General. It's prevalent everywhere.
Yeah,
I don't think sometimes as a male, I don't think I sufficiently appreciate some of the real harm and mental issues that this kind of stuff causes. And you don't have to even be Jeffrey Epstein. You can be something less and cause people a lot of grief.
Yeah. James Arthur, who's here in Washington, D.C., says, given the rumors swirling around about Donald Trump's current health issues, what do we know about his health? Should people in the know speak out?
I don't know. You know, I've been doing these videos back in January of this year, maybe, or something like that. I started pointing out that he had these red splotches on his hand. Speculate. There's nothing. The one thing I know is he doesn't have venous problems in his foot, because they lie about everything. So I don't believe anything they say. But I got to tell you, I woke up. If you woke up in the morning and your foot was as big as your neck, you'd be worried. I mean, there's something wrong there. I don't know. Not meat to figure out. And the cake his whole body would fucking make up. I don't know when you get old up. I'm sure you have the same thing. You break out. You have kind of shit on your arm and, you know, stuff happens. But I don't know what all this means.
You don't think his foot is due to the bone spurs that he had? Remember those awful bone spurs that he had back in the 1960s?
If he told me it was September, I wouldn't believe him. Okay. I don't believe anything he says. But yeah, I don't know if there's anything wrong with him, but whatever he says it is, I know that's not it.
That's true. Well, you know, let me slightly disagree. A broken clock is right twice a day, and I think he accidentally tells the truth, twice a day out of the thousands of times he doesn't.
I'll give it a watch.
I'm being generous. Yeah. John in Long Beach, California, asked a very good question. How would our present Congress have handled Watergate? They'd have taken a dive. They wouldn't have stood up. There wouldn't have been any Howard Baker. There wouldn't have been any Bill Cohen. There wouldn't have been any, you know, Sam Ervin wouldn't have had a chance. And I think the Supreme Court would have gone along with their Republican. So I think that, and the media would have been far different. What Trump is doing is far worse than anything that occurred in Watergate. And he doesn't seem to be paying the price, James.
You know, Albert, I think that this is a possibility. We might have the right to epitaph in the United States that we knew. I hope not. But got to admit, it's somewhat of a possibility. And this country is going to die of cowardice. I mean, I think the whole thing with Biden and now Harris, it was just manifest cowardice.
Yep.
If you look at the Republican Party, it is just a pack of cowards. They don't want to lose a thing. I cannot think of six people that are bigger cowards in American history than the six Republican hacks that sit on the Supreme Court. And look, it's hardly, they did Dred Scott, they did Plessy, they made some terrible decisions, but there was always this faith that it would be self-correcting, that somehow or another the founders gave them this bequeathed them, or they seized, I guess, in Mayberry versus Marshall or whatever the fuck it was. And these people are going to go down as staggering cowards that just bent and manipulated anything that they could to suck up, to graft, and graft not just in government, graft in their own lives, and just anything they could to please power. And history is going to judge them very harshly. And the person that deserves the harshest judgment is John Roberts, because he parades around like he's, and people bought this bullshit that he's a consensus builder and he won't stray too far from this. And at the end of the day, he's a fucking corrupt political hack, and that's all he is.
James, our final question is from Jono. He didn't give us his last name or where he's from, and I normally would rule that question out, but this is worth one that's worth discussing. He said, we referred to Mondami as a, quote, socialist. Jono says, no, he is, in fact, the winner of the Democratic Party primary and thus the Democratic nominee for the office of mayor of New York City, right?
Well, he described himself as a socialist. Yeah, he's a member of the Democratic Socialist Party. I, I'm sorry. It's not, he's a self-described socialist. Now, what does socialism mean? Denmark? Or does socialism mean North Korea? I don't know. I think he would.
It's a lot more Denmark than
socialism. He's a Denmark. I completely agree. But I'm just, the term socialist can mean whatever you want it to mean. And look, if you believe in a robust safety net, and then I'm a socialist. I'll tell you what I'm for. Who knows? I have, but Greg Griffin was born in Denmark. I mean, it's a great country. But no one would say that there's certainly not strong elements of socialism in Denmark, any Nordic society. There is. But look at North Korea. It's not the same country, I promise you.
Yeah, James, you know, months ago, right before that primary, I expressed a hope that Andrew Cuomo would win because I thought that Mondami would become a great foil and Republicans all over the country would run against him, saying he's the Democratic Party. They're trying to do that. A, he's better than I thought. I think he's somewhat naive. Some of that stuff he's never going to get done. Some of it shouldn't be done. And I think Cuomo has really further disgraced himself the way he's behaved in campaign. And so I got to tell you, I don't vote in New York City. But today, if I had a choice between Mondami and Andrew Cuomo, I'd go with Mondami.
Yeah, yes. And, you know, everybody says stuff. He's a Democratic nominee. And by the way, he's going to probably carry the Jewish vote in New York. I mean, I don't like some of the stuff he said, but he's correctly identifying the problem. There's certainly a part of the party that is extremely urban that likes him, and give the guy a chance. He's young and he said some stupid things. Who hadn't said stupid things? But I don't know. I don't have any sense of. By the way, I think Andrew is a damn good governor. I tell that to anybody. I can't tell you people have problems with personality and issues. Losing people on his staff. But in terms of the stuff he did as governor of New York, he was a damn good governor.
You and I would probably slightly differ on that, but, event.
You know, he was very good on gay rights. He's very good to upstate New York. I know that for sure. He probably got a little power mad, but some people do. But he has not laid out anything about what he wants to do mayor in. I don't know what Eric Adams is doing. That guy is like, you tell me something, no self-pride. He might win the award.
And they want to make him ambassador to Saudi Arabia? I can see this administration.
He fit in beautifully there.
Oh, my God. Anyway. Okay. Go Mondami. Hey, listen, we love those questions. If we didn't get to yours this week, please send it in again, and we'll try to get to it next week. One of the hardest things we do every week, is pick out the 7 or so questions that we have time to do on the show, and we love hearing from you, so please. And we haven't heard as much from some of our foreign listeners, so you guys, come on.
Yeah, we're always down under people, huh?
All right, exactly.
Down under.
Yeah. All right. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Naked Wines and ZBiotics, in our episode show notes. We deeply thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Keep up with us. Subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate this show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another program as we continue our War Room planning.